Fortunately, by the time he realized this mistake, the vote had closed and he was unable to change his vote to no.
Congressman Young votes yes, but means no on voluntary labeling for GMO foods. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the ongoing work of fighting fire near Tanana.
We've got probably 20-some miles of hose laid out, protecting structures here, plus on the lines that we're building.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The U.S. House today passed a bill to allow voluntary labeling of food that contains genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Alaska Congressman Don Young voted for the bill, which he says he did by mistake. The bill, if passed by the Senate and signed by the president, would gut state labeling laws. That would nullify Alaska's 10-year-old requirement that any genetically modified salmon sold in the state carry a disclosure to consumers. Michelle Wilson-Nordhoff, an Anchorage mom and self-described natural food shopper, says she wrote Young recently and asked him to vote against the anti-labeling bill. She got a letter back dated Monday.
So he told me in the letter that he wrote to me, he said, rest assured that I will oppose this legislation should it come to the House floor for a vote.
Wilson Nordhoff says she noticed the bill was on the floor today, so she called Young's office to find out how he voted. She says she was stunned when she got a voicemail message telling her the congressman voted for the bill. Wilson Nordhoff says the vote is bad for Alaska's efforts to market its wild salmon.
Yeah, our salmon industry, I think once people find out that Representative Young, Pat, that went ahead and supported this, Alaskans are going to be shocked. I mean, this is definitely a huge issue for our economy.
Young spokesman Matt Shuckrow says it was simply a mistake. Congressman Young pushed the yes button when he meant to push the no button.
Fortunately, by the time he realized this mistake, the vote had closed and he was unable to change his vote to no.
Shuckrow says Young has long supported GMO labeling, particularly for salmon, and after the vote, he submitted a statement for the Congressional Record to clarify his position. Just yesterday, Young wrote a Dear Colleague letter in favor of GMO labeling in which he urged the entire House to vote against the bill that he and the end voted for. Wilson Nordhoff is skeptical that Young's yes vote was just a mistake.
You know, I just think most of these leaders now in Congress just vote according to what corporations want them to vote for. I don't think they're listening to the people and maybe not even to fishing industries in the state anymore.
Shuckrow says Young has sponsored two bills in the House that show his true position. One would ban genetically modified salmon, and the other would require product labeling for GMO fish. Young has also explained his accidental vote in a Facebook posting. Yesterday, Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced an energy bill that steered clear of hot-button issues to ensure Democratic support. Today, the Alaska Republicans sponsored a separate energy bill of just hot buttons. The bill would end the ban on exports of crude oil. It also includes state revenue sharing for offshore oil development. The bill would direct revenues from Alaska's outer continental shelf to the state, coastal communities, and tribes. The bill also has revenue sharing for the Gulf of Mexico and the Southern Atlantic. Alaska Governor Bill Walker is in Washington, D.C., making the case with the military for restoring proposed personnel cuts. Walker says he stressed Alaska's strategic importance, especially with Russia enhancing its military presence in the Arctic. Walker says military leaders express their strong preference to not be making troop reductions, but that the reductions are tied to automatic federal spending cuts known as sequestration. The Army told the Alaska Congressional Delegation on July 8th that it planned a reduction of more than 2,600 paratrooper positions at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage and 75 troops at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. The Anchorage base is one of six domestic bases that will lose 1,200 or more soldiers as part of a cost-saving plan to reduce the active duty force by 40,000 troops over 2 years. Recent rain slowed wildfire growth around the interior, but there are still nearly 200 active blazes and more than 20 staffed fires. The largest response is to a 500,000-acre complex of fires near Tanana. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, managers expect suppression and demobilization to take weeks.
Like many of the big wildfires in the interior, the five blazes around Tanana were started by abundant lightning that hit the region a month ago. One of the two largest, the Spicer Creek Fire, has sandwiched the village up against the Yukon River. Bill Paxton, an information officer with the Lower 48 Base team managing the response, says over 350 people are working both quiet and active areas of the fire.
While we're doing rehab and cleanup, you know, pulling hose on one part of the fire, we're over actively building line on another, you know, where the threat is.
Paxton says there's potential for the Spicer fire to spring back to life as the weather warms and dries this week, and the priority continues to be protecting the community.
We've got probably 20-some miles of hose laid out, protecting structures here, plus on the lines that we're building.
Paxton identifies the current area of concern as northwest of Tanana, where crews are directly attacking the fire.
Building a defensible line all the way to this stream called Bear Creek, and from Bear Creek all the way to the Yukon. It's tough going. It's hand work, a lot of saw work, and they're taking hose lays as they go along. The water is coming from the Yukon River a couple miles.
Paxton says structure protection like hoses and sprinklers remain in place along 150 miles of the Yukon River, where the Spicer and four other large fires have threatened to advance for a month. He says the management team is committed to running the fire response through the end of July, after which the plan is to transition to a smaller organization. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state budget cuts cause stress for small community law enforcement.
The state needs to have a jail here. We need to have that type of facility here in Petersburg. Without that facility, we would have a negative impact on our quality of life, and it would negatively impact our public safety.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The municipality of Anchorage has taken a big step toward opposing the proposed bridge called the Kinnick Arm Crossing Project. Just days after an unusually large showing of community opposition to two large transportation projects in the city, the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions, or AMATS, Policy Committee passed a resolution raising concerns about the Kinnick project. It's a rare step and one that set the stage for deprioritization or elimination of the controversial bridge project down the line. The resolution introduced by Anchorage Assemblymember Patrick Flynn expresses reservations about the financial viability, environmental toll, and impact to neighborhoods near the bridge's proposed route. It asks for planners to revisit whether it's worth pursuing the project as they draft the next version of a long-term transportation plan during the year ahead. The resolution addresses community concerns without demanding a substantial revision to an interim plan, thus sidestepping a risk that Anchorage would lapse on federal compliance standards. A New York man was arrested last week for making threatening phone calls to Arizona schools that were motivated by online gaming on an Xbox, authorities say. Details of the calls sound similar to ones made to Alaska schools, though the FBI says the arrest hasn't been connected. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The FBI arrested 29-year-old Victor Lisniak of New York on July 15th for making several threatening calls to schools in Flagstaff, Arizona. Stacy Fager-Pelessier is a spokeswoman for the FBI in Anchorage.
At this point, I do not have the information that it is related to the cases in Alaska.
At least 8 threatening phone calls in April and May disrupted Juneau schools. Similar phone calls were made to schools all over the state, including Anchorage, Fairbanks, Talkeetna, Soldotna, Kenai, and Hoonah. The phone threats to Juneau schools alluded to school shootings, and the caller had a computer-generated or robotic-sounding voice. Investigators reported similar details in the Flagstaff calls. Lizniak told Flagstaff detectives he made threatening phone calls to schools in the United States, so many he doesn't remember all the specific calls. According to the charging document, it says the calls were in response to online video gaming. He would gain points for making these calls and at times had to make these calls if he lost a game. Lizniak is suspected of making calls between March and May. He could face 25 years in prison and a $1.25 million fine. FBI spokeswoman Fager Pellissier says the Alaska calls are still under investigation. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
4 local residents are being charged with criminal trespass and theft for stealing oysters from a farm on the south side of Ketchumek Bay on the 4th of July. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Oyster theft is unfortunately not an uncommon crime around Ketchumek Bay, an area with more than a dozen mariculture sites dotting its coastline. On July 13th, Alaska State Troopers received a call from an oyster grower in Jackaloff Cove.
The oyster farm had essentially pulled up a batch of its oysters and realized that there weren't nearly as many as there should have been.
Megan Peters is a spokesperson for the troopers.
And after they did that, they went back and they reviewed their security footage because they do have security cameras around their operation, and they noticed that on July 4th, there was a group of 4 adults that were on the docks that did not have any kind of permission to be there. Essentially, those individuals stole oysters from their oyster farm.
Through images from the security tape, they were able to identify 3 of the 4 people as Homer Deputy Harbor Master Matt Clark, his wife Rebecca, and local resident Christine Kulcheski.
And we made contact with the 3 people that they had identified. Those people did cooperate with us. Through our efforts, we were able to identify the 4th person that was involved, and charges are also being pursued against that individual.
The name of the 4th person has not been released yet. The 2 Clarks and Kulcheski are being charged with 4th-degree theft and 1st-degree criminal trespass. The number of oysters and their monetary value have not been disclosed yet. Deputy Harbor Master Clark was contacted but did not wish to provide comment at this time. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Subsistence fishing is open indefinitely on the Kuskokwim River, but that hasn't been the norm this summer as the river underwent 2 management regimes, state and federal, and strict closures for 2 species. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports that lower river fishermen are adjusting to the new reality of Kuskokwim subsistence, where conservative management is now the status quo.
On a sunny Saturday, after a 4-hour subsistence opener, Joe Green and his 2 kids shuttle salmon up the steep banks at the Bethel Small Boat Harbor from the skiff to the back of their pickup. These openers are critical for Green as he fishes for 4 families.
Well, this year we're shooting for anything.
Really?
The feds and the government chuck, you know. They screw up everything for us. So we get what we can.
On top of his chums, he caught just shy of a dozen red salmon and says he'll be freezing fish for the first time this summer. It's a summer of flexibility on the Kuskokwim. Unprecedented king salmon restrictions were followed up by more closures to protect a weak chum run, which so far at the Bethel Test Fishery ranks among the lowest in history. Alyssa Joseph works on the fishery staff for Bethel's tribe ONC and is traveling the river, speaking with fishermen in the Bethel area's 150 or so fish camps.
We don't go to fish camps to look at their racks and, you know, stuff like that. We go to get their information and how they did. We don't need to know, like, how much fish they got and stuff like that. We just want to know how subsistence is going, how it's working out for them, and, you know, how can we be of assistance as advocates for them.
The information goes to state and federal managers, as well as the Kuskokwim Working Group. Joseph was checking in on subsistence fishermen like Nikolai Ivan. At his Napuskiak fish camp, his family is cutting and preparing fish caught in the opener. He normally catches around 100 kings each summer. So far this year, he's caught 10. how he plans to make up the deficit?
Caribou, moose, seal, geese, swans. It's my part of life is subsistence. I hardly go to store once in a great while, though.
Nearby, David Nikolai reports that his family also caught significantly fewer kings than normal, but it's enough for them to get by.
Enough for this year.
Enough for the year.
Enough. Good enough for fish.
Uh-huh.
Well, lots of fish out there, lots of tums, lots of rats, some king salmon.
Besides being large, rich, and historically abundant, king salmon are also prized for their immaculate timing. They're first when the weather's clear and dry. But at this point in the season, it's clear that things have changed. Under the roof of Marie Andrews' drying rack, the Nabuskiak resident is busy putting chums and reds up to dry. The red salmon this year fortunately came on strong and relatively late, but this time of year, Andrew is starting to see flies.
During that smoky, you know, when the fire smoke was around, there wasn't that much. But then lately, I've seen lots, like today, when the sun was out.
She says she's typically done by now in a normal king year. Near Bethel, Sugar Henderson is looking forward to silvers. She says her family took part in the limited community permit system at the start of the year and was allocated a dozen kings.
I normally do strips with my kings and then dry fish with my silvers. But knowing I was only going to get 12 kings, I went ahead and did all dry fish. And then with the pressure cooker that we have, we figured we'd try the strips with the silvers, kind of backwards.
And after several years of poor king returns and the stop-and-go restrictions, Henderson has had to adapt.
We've learned to adjust to what we get. I'm not one that's out there yelling and screaming, oh my God, you know, we need our kings, we need our kings. We do need our kings, but I understand the fact that they need to replenish, and so we've just adjusted ourselves, our lifestyle, to what we could get.
And as long as Kuskokwim salmon runs and regulations defy prediction, summer fishing plans will remain a moving target. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Budget cuts to state troopers are taking place all across Alaska, but in small southeast communities like Petersburg, it's a double whammy. That's because community jails are also taking a hit, and the two are inextricably linked. KFSK's Joe Sykes explains.
When you think of doing time, most people imagine something on a grand scale, like out of the film The Shawshank Redemption. But the community jails in Southeast are a little different from that.
Our jail facility here, this is our visitation room. This is our main cell block.
Kelly Swihart, who's Petersburg's chief of police, is showing me a cell block made up of two rooms lodged at the back of the Petersburg police station. He takes me into one of the cells.
There's nobody in this cell. Yeah, we have two steel bunks with some mattresses here, and also over in the corner is a combination unit of a sink and a toilet. It's pretty sparse.
The maximum stay here is 15 days at the moment. After that, an inmate will be transferred to a larger facility in Juneau or Ketchikan. The state troopers are responsible for the transportation of people from community jails. But there are no law enforcement troopers in Petersburg, and Swihart thinks the swinging cuts to the state troopers' budget will make it difficult for them to move prisoners in good time.
The chain of command at Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety are really going to have to get together and figure out how they're going to arrange those transports and, you know, get folks out of here.
And he says what makes it extra hard is the Department of Corrections has also slashed the budget for community jails. Petersburg state funding will be cut a further third this year, from $320,000 to $185,000. So Swihart put in a proposal which would limit the length of stay in Petersburg's jail to 9 days. That would make it even harder for the state troopers to get there on time.
Well, the cuts to the community jails has been a great concern of the Alaska State Troopers.
That's Colonel James Cockrell. He's the director of Alaska State Troopers. He says he's already seeing a backlash from police departments in small communities, as the troopers do not have the budget anymore to act as effectively in moving prisoners.
We are the face of state government, and we're the ones interacting with the local police departments, and we're the ones that's going to have to pick up the backload when they start reducing their services. We're starting to get an adversarial relationship with the small police departments.
And much of the issue here is about maintaining relationships. The Department of Corrections controls the budget for the jails, while the Department of Public Safety deals with the state troopers. Alaska State Troopers are being told to cut a further $2.6 million this year. With both agencies making severe cuts, Cockrell says they will have to start to prioritize services.
There might be occasions where we're not going to have the manpower to make a transport, but more likely it'll happen is we'll make the transport and then the trooper won't be able to respond to a call for service.
And this is something that really concerns Kelly Swihart, but he thinks whatever happens, the community jails need to stay open.
The state needs to have a jail here. We need to have that type of facility here in Petersburg. Without that facility, we would have a negative impact on our quality of life and it would negatively impact our public safety.
And for the time being, the jail here is safe. But Swihart says it may not be long before further cuts spell closing time for community jails across the state. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
Haines residents Jen Walsh and Jessica Kaiser Forrester are likely the first women to summit the 6,400-foot Mount Emmerich in the Chilkat Valley, also known as Cathedral Peaks. They made the trek in early July with Chris Downer and Kevin Forrester. Local climbers say fewer than 10 ascents of Emmerich have happened since the first one in 1976, and Forrester and Walsh are thought to be the only women to complete the climb. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
Kevin looked at Jess and me and said, "You guys, this is it. I mean, if we are going to turn around and get back to our tents or off the snowfield before the sun hits the snow, then we need to turn around now."
That's Jen Walsh. That moment in the climb where Kevin Forrester asked his companions if they wanted to turn around happened because of unexpected conditions. The group had hiked from sea level and made their base camp in the Cathedral Cirque, a glacier bench at about 3,700 feet. Right away, they noticed something different. Here's Jessica Forrester.
It was really surprising how little snow and ice there was. So you have this mountain up there that is being exposed for the first time because it's been covered in snow and ice for so long, which brought about a lot of objective hazards now.
Less snowpack meant more technical snow and rock climbing than they expected. Kevin Forrester had summited Emmerich before, and his trip up from the base camp and back down took 9 hours total. They could tell that that was not going to happen this time. The group was less than halfway up when they had to make a decision.
There's no way that we can make this. We can get up there and come back down in time and not be in the heat of the day. And so we know it's going to be calm and 80, so it could be safe to be on the summit. So the other option is we just keep climbing through the night and we spend the day on the summit and then come down that evening. And we decided to do that.
Forrester and Walsh say they climbed during the night because colder weather makes for safer conditions. Trying to climb at that elevation when it's sunny and 80 degrees would be dangerous because the heat makes the surfaces less stable. It took 14 hours to climb up from their base camp to the summit along the south ridge of the peak. Walsh remembers how it felt when they made it to the top.
To be with all of your friends right there and know that you just did something that took everything is amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like we've done some big things together before, but maybe I just haven't felt that kind of emotion. And it just sort of, it opened up gates and that was my moment.
Their view was a sea of mountains, which they had hours to take in since they couldn't descend during the hot daytime hours.
It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, because usually you get to the top of a mountain and or the top of a climb and you just turn around and go back down. You don't spend much time on summits, but in this particular instance, we peaked out at around 7 o'clock in the morning and we proceeded to spend 10 hours on the summit.
Forrester and Walsh say the most physically exhausting part of the trip wasn't the summit. It was hiking out of the cirque. The group had arranged for a plane to drop food into their base camp. But leaving, they had to carry all the leftover supplies out on their backs. The lack of snow also made that part of the trek more difficult. Walsh says the hike out took 13 hours.
I kind of like activities that involve some suffering, but this was incredible. It was a lot of work, but it was really a lot of staying mentally focused. And I think coming back down, I thought to myself, I might not be strong enough for this.
Walsh and Forrester are probably the first women to summit the cathedrals. But since some ascents are not officially recorded, it's hard to know for sure. Jack Tackle was one of the climbers to make the first ascent of Emmerich in 1976. He and Haynes climbing enthusiast John Svensson both say that they don't know of any other women who have summited Emmerich. The American Alpine Club also did not know of any other female climbers who have reported summiting the cathedrals. Forrester and Walsh give a lot of credit to Chris and Kevin, but they say they wouldn't have done it without each other. Here's Forrester.
There's so much more when there's another woman with you. Mm-hmm. And I can't really explain it, but it just makes you stronger.
Forrester says the scene from the adventure that stays with her the most is when they were hiking back along the glacier after the summit climb. It was 1 a.m. and the moon was bright in the sky. The whole horizon was lit up pink and red. They walked in silence between jagged mountain peaks, and the whole Chilkat Valley was beneath their feet. In Haynes, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Joe Sykes in Petersburg, and Emily Files in Haynes. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.